Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, except not Amy today, and for Amy today is Charles Thomas, former ABC 7 political reporter. Charles, welcome.
And good morning, good morning, good morning.
Good morning.
Great to be here, man. I've always thought of this show as an island of sanity amid the chaos.
Island of sanity amid the chaos. We're going to have to put that on our brochures. I like
good,
that.
Man.
Thank you. Very
sounds
good.
Sounds like a promotional spot.
Very good. So you have connections to both Kansas City and Philadelphia. So who were you rooting for last night?
I was rooting for Kansas City. Both my offspring, now adults, were born in Kansas City. My first job at KCMO Radio, Odd Country Radio. I was the morning agriculture reporter.
Sure.
When I got out of college, my first job worked midnight to 8 a.m. in the morning.
Because you went to Mizzou.
I went to Mizzou, and that
and
was
my farmer.
First day.
You're a farmer? You were just a farmer?
Well, it depends on what you call farmer. What am I growing?
Okay.
You know, late 60s, you know.
Before there was Orion Samuelson, there was Charles Thomas doing the crop reports.
We had a guy named Paul Pippert, and he would come to the newsroom, and he would get the guys together to buy a boxcar of March wheat or soybeans or something like that, or whatever he thought was hot that would go up in price, and he would, you know, we'd all give him $100 or something like that, and maybe get back 200.
Okay.
Maybe get back 50.
Right. Yes.
It's a really dicey thing. But anyway, I mean, it was a great experience.
Did you have any knowledge or background in agriculture?
None.
Yeah.
Zero.
Exactly. Perfect.
Absolutely none.
Yeah, that's what people are sometimes confused. They think if you're on the radio or TV, you have expert knowledge on something, and you don't have to.
And, you know, I would read these terms like barrows and gilts. Those are hogs I found out.
Is
much
that right?
Later.
Okay.
Much later, after I left the job, you know, I found out, what was I talking about? You know, heifers and I didn't even know what a steer was.
I always wondered what I was talking about at that job that I had. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were Kansas City and Philadelphia.
I worked in Philly for 6 years in the early 1980s. At CBS, and then at what is now the Fox station in Philly. And, you know, I enjoyed Philly a lot. Philly was a lot like Chicago, but a lot dirtier. I mean, Philly, yeah. We used to call it Filthadelphia, but a great place. I mean, people ate a lot of dough. I mean, they love those pretzels, cheesesteaks, and pizza.
People eat, they like dough.
I called it the dough belt.
They like dough, and they like turning over cars and climbing on street lights.
They turned over a car, apparently, before.
Pre-game. Part of the pre-game. Pre-game warm-up.
No, I love Philly. I mean, the salutation in Philly is the F-bomb.
Yeah, I was wondering how long it would take for them to turn on the Eagles and call for Nick Sirianni to be fired after last night's narrow loss.
Give him a couple of days.
Yeah, then, right.
You know,
yeah.
And Hurts. I thought Hurts played a tremendous game, except for the fumble. That was the key. That fumble and then that punt return.
Well,
those are the two things that.
Yeah, the punt return, definitely. But also, I mean, again, I was rooting for Kansas City, as you were. Don't like Philadelphia fans. Jalen Hurts, great player. He had a great game. Philadelphia played pretty well. The adjustments, though, Andy Reid, you know, comes back to haunt Philadelphia. Adjustments he made at halftime after Philadelphia really was in control of that game in the first half. But
I hate to do this. I hate to do it in the AFC Championship game too. But just like you cannot make that personal foul call in the AFC Championship game against the Bengals, you cannot make that defensive holding call that they made at the end of the game.
Those refs know who the great players are. They knew that Mahomes could make that throw and that they wouldn't have made that call against Justin Fields because he hasn't proven he can consistently make that throw. But they know that Mahomes can make that throw. So they threw the flag on that guy because that was a hold, but it was a ticky-tack.
Well, it's a ticky-tack hold, but the whole point is if it's a ticky-tack foul, you can't call a ticky-tack foul when the game's on the line. You just can't do it. It dampened it for me, even though, no, but talk about Mahomes after re-injuring his ankle near the end of the first half. I mean, that was a command performance.
Look,
one for the ages. I
got one thing to say about that. Whatever happened in the locker room at halftime, I want what he had.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I'll have what he's having. Yeah, you know, it's funny about Mahomes. This was posted yesterday as a little bit of a reminder and a turning the knife in the back of Chicago Bears fans. This is Pat Mahomes's, this is over at the Players Tribune, Pat Mahomes's letter in April of 2017 before the draft to NFL coaches and general managers. I mean, I'll read a part of this, but Mitch Trubisky must have written a hell of a personal statement.
Hell of a letter. I mean, that was a heck of a letter.
He writes, "You've watched me run and jump and lift weights and throw a ball as far as I can. You've wondered a lot if I can adjust to the speed of the program and adapt to the complexity of an NFL offense. All those things are important, and for the most part, they all involve football in some way, but they're still not quite football. That's not the same thing as being out there in a game, in the huddle with my team. Football is under the lights, facing the elements in front of 60,000 people. It's keeping your guys motivated, whatever the circumstances, and having the determination to bring your team back seemingly from seemingly certain defeat in the fourth quarter." Gee, that's a little foreshadowing. "It's doing everything you can to make a play in the red zone. Sometimes the play breaks down and you have to be creative. I'm not perfect, but football isn't always perfect. It doesn't always go the way you expect. I know that I might not have given the perfect answer for every one of your questions. You saw some mistakes on my tape, and I missed a couple of throws on pro day. But I hope you noticed that every answer I gave was sincere, and that when I made a mistake on the field, I always held myself accountable. I hope you realize I can do a lot more than just throw the ball far. I don't want you to think that a big arm is the only thing that got me here. I'm a football player, and I'm ready to do the job as your quarterback." The Bears read that and said, "No thanks."
I read it for the first time this morning.
Incredible.
And I'm telling you, that letter should be required reading for anybody playing the game.
This is 5, 6 years ago now. He closes, "I will not whine or complain during the process. I won't be a distraction on or off the field. I will put in the hours to master your playbook. I won't stop until I get everything right down to the smallest detail. I may make mistakes along the way, and I won't win every single game I play during my career. I won't retire with a perfect passer rating or zero career interceptions, but I'll try as hard as anybody." And the Bears said, "We'll go with Mitch Trubisky." Jesus. I mean, you could randomly select anybody who's played fantasy football for 5 days and have Pat Mahomes on draft day.
Maybe they thought he was grifting, man. Maybe they thought he was a good writer. Yeah. Better writer than quarterback.
Well, but I don't know how they thought that if they saw him play at Texas Tech. Also, too, he talked about it in his letter, what he learned from watching his dad pitch in the majors and learning the work ethic that was required and the grind that is. And so, I mean, I just thought going back 6 years, not to mention how precocious, not to point out just how precocious he was, but also just, of course, because that Bears pick will live in infamy the way that Sam Bowie over Jordan will live in infamy for the Blazers or something.
Yeah.
Did you get into the Super Bowl ads at all?
You know, no. I mean, I was watching at home, and I didn't go to the Super Bowl party to which I was invited. So I watched with my wife, who knows absolutely nothing about football.
Uh-huh.
She watches for the commercials. I'm going to the fridge when they come on.
What about Rihanna?
Oh man, that was I look. I'm a look. I am a pop culture moron. I don't know one Rihanna song. Okay.
All right.
But I looked at this woman who had this, you know, she had like a paunch, man.
Well, she's pregnant.
She looked like me.
Well, she's pregnant. She has an excuse.
Oh. But, you know, she looked like, I didn't know that. I didn't know she was pregnant either,
but I mean, I figured she wasn't drinking beer.
She had a really puffy face.
Yeah.
She wasn't like beautiful like J-Lo, man, you know, or something, you know, like
oh,
and
boy.
And you know, and,
oh, boy,
and
now
she
I'm
had
really getting
all,
to it.
And all of these who are these? What was the point of those people in white suits?
The like dancing
sunglasses?
Ewoks thing?
Yeah,
I like the dancing Ewoks and I like the aerial. I actually thought it was kind of cool.
It must have been 800 of them.
I also thought it was really impressive. She went through not only that she could still move a little bit, and she's pregnant, but that she went through the catalog of her songs, you know, seamlessly. There's a lot of songs.
Oh, really?
Songs
you know a lot of her songs.
Yeah, I mean, I hear it on the radio, but I mean, there was a lot of songs that she went through. You know, playing just singing just a few lines from each over the course of that performance. I thought that was actually pretty good. And, I want to be critical.
When it was over, I just looked at my wife and said, is that all there is? I mean,
Did your wife like it?
She recognized this. She did. Because she was sitting there like, you know, mesmerized by it.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, looking for, you know, another glass of wine.
I don't know. I mean, given previous halftime shows where like The Weeknd takes us to the gates of hell, I thought this was, you know, this was good and sort of center cut, and it was artistically pleasing to view. And
yeah, okay.
Michael Strahan seemed to like it. I saw he was dancing on the sidelines.
Michael Strahan, he's a man of a million places and things, and he goes everywhere, right? He's like
he is
a Renaissance.
Nobody's leveraged their NFL career better than Michael Strahan.
Yeah,
there's
no doubt
about it.
He's got the two networks paying him. Right?
Well, all right, we'll get to some Super Bowl ads, despite Charles's lack of interest, a little bit later on in the show.
I watched some of them. I didn't go out and buy like a new electric EV
because
whatever,
Will Ferrell's driving
that,
around.
I didn't go out and get some Doritos, although I like Doritos. You know the different varieties of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and in for Amy this morning, former ABC 7 political reporter Charles Thomas. We were talking a little bit about the Super Bowl. We'll get back to some other aspects of the Super Bowl, not the game itself, but some of the other cultural aspects a bit later. Charles, you're happy about the Chiefs. Are you happy about your choices for mayor of the city of Chicago? Where are you on the mayor's race as we stand here just a couple of weeks from primary day?
Let me begin with a disclaimer that I do not understand how the vast majority of Chicagoans vote. I usually vote in the opposite direction. Okay, that done. Right now, I think that Paul Vallas clearly will win a plurality of the vote, probably the high 20%. The real dogfight will be over who can finish second and can face Vallas in the runoff. And believe me, that person who finishes second could very well emerge as the favorite in the runoff, but that could be, you name it. That could be Chewy Garcia. That could be Brandon Johnson. That could be, of course, the incumbent, although I think she's in real trouble. And or it could be Willie Wilson, depending on how well he's able to appeal to voters outside the black community. And I'm sensing that he might be doing better at that lately. And a lot of the libs in Chicago are saying that his comment about hunting them down like rabbits is hurting him. Well, I don't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think people understand that he doesn't want to go out and shoot people like you'd shoot a rabbit. I mean, they know that because they know Willie Wilson.
Of course.
Yeah, so, but if he's going to be aggressive about fighting crime, then that is appealing, I believe, to voters of all stripes all over the city, because that is, and I live in the city, downtown, that is the major problem facing Chicago right now. That's what's chasing the businesses out of the city of Chicago, chasing the premium taxpayers, if you will, as I'll call them, out of the city of Chicago. Excuse me. So
what does Willie need to do to get from, you know, the 12% to 15% to that pocket where the other candidates are ostensibly, you know, the second place candidate that makes the runoff in particular, you know, upper teens to low 20s? What does he need to do?
He needs to get a white person to say, I'm voting for Willie Wilson. And he needs to have that person on a commercial. And it doesn't have to be some high profile white person. It has to be a white person who lives in a neighborhood who's concerned about the city, to say that he shares or she shares Willie's concern, to get over this race thing. Because, you know, the...
What about you? Has he used Ray Lopez, Alderman Ray Lopez, enough?
I think that works. That helps.
Yeah, helps.
He needs a Northwest Sider, a 19th Warder from the Southwest Side, somebody like that, to say, I'm voting for Willie Wilson because Willie is going to be the guy that's going to get the city back under control. And the other thing, too, is that as a black man, I am interested in Willie Wilson because I know that Willie Wilson can do what needs to be done. I mean, there's going to have to, because they're going to, if Paul Vallis does it or Chewy does it, and we know Lori isn't doing it, if they were elected and they had to do it, then they'd be called a racist. Because it's gonna have to be done. I mean, you know, Brandon Johnson talks about going after the root causes of crime and job programs and all that stuff.
Right.
What are you gonna do to help the person get home from work
tomorrow
at night, tomorrow on the red line?
Right.
And ride the buses. What are you gonna do now? And I think Willie is saying, I know what has to happen now. We have to really be firm about law and order in the city. And you know, he can do it, whereas I don't think Paul Vallis can do it or Chewy can do it without a lot of pushback.
With respect to, so it's interesting, why is that a fault of Willie Wilson, the campaign? Is it a nature of the racial politics of the city? Is it attendant to what people generally think about Willie Wilson? Particularly, even though he enjoys some Republican Party support, like from me, are they not thinking that way? Why doesn't he do that where he has somebody from the 19th Ward or the Northwest Side say, listen, this isn't about race. This is about who gets the job done. And this guy is the only one who's got the sobriety and the wherewithal to do the things that need to be done to make this city safer.
I think, you know, Willie's big problem, if I can just say this first, is that he's just not the communicator.
Yeah, right.
He's not. But right. I think his handlers don't have the range to do that. Ricky Hendon, the former state senator.
Hollywood Hendon
is handling a lot of Willie's campaign. And Ricky just doesn't have the range to do what he needs to do, let's say in the far Southwest Side, 19th Ward, or on the northwest side. And I think that is a problem. Maybe they can fix it. They've got time to fix it.
Not much.
Not much, but they've got some time.
Yeah.
And maybe they're working on this. I mean, I haven't talked to them about it. But I think that would help Willie because Willie, I think, bottom line, if you go beyond the surface stuff and the scurrilous charges that Lori Lightfoot makes and this stuff about hunting them down like rabbits, if you get past that, I mean, I think Willie is the only one with any real conservative bona fides, right? I mean, let's face it. I mean, he's a former Trump voter. He supported Republican candidates for governor.
Mm-hmm.
He's a business person, a free enterprise guy. The language thing, of course, is a problem. But if you go past all that, I mean, I think he can appeal to the moderate, the conservative people in the city. Now, you know, this isn't a very moderate or conservative city. I get that.
No, but when you're in a race to 20% and, you know, you have a certain percentage of the black vote, and if you could make an appeal to and gather a significant percentage of the 1 in 6.5 voters who identify as Republicans in the city, well, and then you're starting to cook with fire a little bit, at least to get to the runoff.
To get to the runoff, exactly.
And I'm a little surprised he hasn't made more of a formal overture in that direction, because you do have to stitch these coalitions together. And I also think that, I mean, he shared the story of his son, which is a powerful story, and it certainly provides more layering to him. But I also think he needs to, and we had him on the show and we talked about this. I talked about this with him. I also think he needs to make his style of communication an asset rather than a liability. And he had a riff when I sort of pressed him on it, because nobody has the guts to just ask him about it when everybody knows and he knows too. So it's like it's not like a secret. So he basically said, "Look, I'm comfortable with this. This is who I am. This represents, you know, my life's journey, and it also is a signal to people that maybe have their own struggles. That look, you can have your own struggles with." Oration or whatever they may be, and you could still find success in business the way I found. You could still be run for mayor of the city of Chicago, one of the biggest cities in America. And I thought that's a great answer, and I think it's an authentic answer, and I think his authenticity doesn't, you know, he needs to be packaging authenticity, but I mean, I'm saying it needs to be communicated to a broader audience so that people see it, and the handle on him isn't just always snippet, where he's hard to decipher, or you know, these ghastly debates that are non-debates, right?
Yeah, he, you know, Willie Wilson is a composite of the black people who have come to Chicago over the last 100 years during that so-called Great Migration. He came here. He's got the eighth grade education. In other words, he doesn't have a lot of formal education. A lot of them didn't have that either. But they came here and they found success. They found success. I mean, all you hear about from a lot of the people in Chicago are negatives. Willie is the epitome of the embodiment of the Great Migration and what it meant. He came here. He got involved in business. He worked hard. He started mopping floors at McDonald's. He grew it. He grew that business into another business. He is the American dream.
And it's such a, you know, that's the other thing, too. I know the story goes that he went directly to Ray Kroc for a job.
Well, after he had been mopping floors.
Right.
At McDonald's.
Right. Not a job, but to level up. Like, mm-hmm. how do I want to own a franchise one day?
Right.
Right. And that, I mean, so that's alone. And I like other franchise owners, or I just don't understand why and I have the same criticism of people like Paul Vallis, too. I don't understand why they're not bringing more people in to display some of and give more understanding of who they are and what they've done. Why don't we see people from Philly and New Orleans, in addition to Chicago, standing up with Paul Vallis and saying, you know, he was instrumental in turning our schools around and making and providing educational opportunities to people who have been left behind for so long in New Orleans and Philadelphia, just as he did in Chicago 30 years ago and so on and so forth. You know, stitch it together for us. Stitch a life together for us. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, you know, Willie has an opportunity to again, he is the embodiment of that. But I think in terms of, like, the crime situation, Willie can speak to this issue in the black community that nobody wants to talk about, and that is the proliferation of single-parent families and what that has meant to the community, and the fact that black women are not being married anymore. You got this baby daddy, baby mama culture that has taken over. And I think Willie is a person that can address that kind of thing, and that black folks will listen to him. If you decreased the number of children being raised, black children being raised in single parent families, and right now it's around 80%. Can you believe that? 80% of black children being raised in single parent families. You reduce that number, and I guarantee you, you'll reduce poverty, you'll reduce crime.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636 DA, turnkey.pro text line. Ron, Southside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good to hear you, Charles.
Good morning, Ron.
Two things. Brandon Johnson said seniors and people with disabilities should be able to ride CTA free. Those are the most vulnerable people on CTA. I'm a senior. I'm not getting on CTA. You can pay me, let alone a discount. Boy, but real quick, and Charles, you said that you feel as if Willie could fix the problem relative to crime. I don't see any evidence of that, Charles. Maybe you can't.
Well, I do.
His story is great.
Listen to what I just said, that if there is somebody out there that can speak to young people, black people, about what's happened to our family, our nuclear family, somebody black who can speak to black people, because right now the liberal establishment doesn't want to talk about that. They call you
racist. Okay, turn that around.
So you got to start talking about that. That's my major complaint with Barack Obama, that during his second term, he did not address that problem. And I think that if that problem is addressed, we can affect crime. We can affect poverty. If we start respecting the family again and move back toward the nuclear family and have everybody talking about it, put up some billboards on that. You know, in the black community, talking about family and reconstituting the black family.
Okay, real quick. Key word, what you said, young people and communicating. His appeal comes from older people like myself.
But he can commission young people to do that.
You think that he's able to communicate effectively with young people out here with that message? I just disagree, y'all. Communication is very, very important. There are cultural differences, the age difference. I don't think he's an effective enough speaker to do that. But that's just that's my thought. So good hearing you. And but one thing about it, this is I don't really like any of the candidates. None of them really get me going. But I'm just trying to get it figured out. You guys have a good day.
Thanks, Ron. Appreciate it. Philip, Blue Island.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the insult of being, if you're not married, and then this whole thing about blacks not being in the household, that's an insult to all these young brothers that's out here taking care of their children that wants to be part of their life. So that's just an insult. And again, Willie Wilson is unable to articulate anything that anybody who's probably younger than 50 can, you know, okay, you're going to give away gas and give away cards and, you know, all these gimmicks that he's doing. But then again, you get on a panel or a debate and you just sitting there just mean and can't articulate and attacking the women on the panel, and especially Lori Lightfoot, you know. So he comes across as a straight up conservative, and just like you, Charles, it's just disappointing that you would say some of the things that you're saying to the black community and then expect somebody to come to your side or try to understand what you. No, it's just a bunch of insults. And
if you think a man and woman living together, raising their children, is an insult, then you take it the way you must.
That's not what I said.
I believe that if you father a child and you are a mother and you give birth to a child, you have a responsibility to parent that child. And when these young people are out here in the street sticking guns in people's faces, then a lot of those people did not come from two-parent families. That's a fact.
Well,
I can't change that.
And the other thing, Philip, and I put you on hold for a second, the other thing is, I mean, just Charles didn't say guys that had a baby out of wedlock who are taking care of their kids are doing anything wrong. They're doing something right. But we understand, and the scholarship on this is couldn't be more overwhelming, that the best environment to raise kids is a intact two-parent family. It doesn't mean that they're not heroic single moms and single dads that do it right and kids turn out great. That's not saying that an 80% illegitimacy rate or a 50% illegitimacy rate in the white community. You can't say that is a good thing. It does not turn out well writ large. That's the point. Not that there are not exceptions. The overall product of that sort of culture is the issue. All right, Philip, go ahead.
I understand, and I appreciate that. But all I'm saying about that is the relationship and the language. And if you're trying to get somebody to vote for you, that language is detrimental to anybody voting for you or appealing to you or liking you. And so when again, you're saying to these young people, okay, they're in these children's lives, they're taken care of, but that's not mentioned. You know, you're always going to go to the marriage.
I mean, that's good, but I'm saying that it's better if they are living together, if they're married, living together in the same house with the child that they brought into this world.
What's to say that they're not living in the house? Well, real quick, because I know I ain't got time. But what says they're not living in the house with the child? The statistics say that the woman is single, but that don't mean that she's not with the man is not in the house. That's a misnomer.
Thanks.
Stop it.
Thanks for the call, Philip. Well, I mean, again, what we know about that cultural phenomena is that it doesn't work very well for most of the children, certainly in comparison to children in a more stable environment.
And you think about
That's all. I mean, it's just, it's like, this is part of the problem is that Chicago is the base camp for beautiful lies. And so you can't just say something that is just absolutely true. And there's overwhelming evidence, all these men and women of data and science, overwhelming evidence. And say, yeah, I get it, and I'm not attacking anybody, but we just know what the best model is.
But, Dan, that's why you have trouble saying that, because you get that kind of pushback that somehow I'm insulting somebody or that it's racist to say that.
Nothing is better than anything else.
The matter is
right.
That it's better when a child is raised by the people that brought them into the world.
Everything everybody does is morally equivalent and has an equal chance of success. That's not true. Every behavior is morally equivalent and has an equal chance of a successful outcome. That is not true. So, and if you're insulted by that, then you're probably engaged in behavior that has a less of a chance of success. And you don't want to be confronted by it. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hi, good morning. You can hear me okay. I still think that it's going to come down to Willie Wilson and Paul Vallis, because I think, you know, but the last caller, you know, obviously doesn't agree, but Willie has the history with the, you know, he's got to just get it across to the people about the son and the business, because that's very relatable to a lot of people, you know, didn't go to college. You know, smart people who
found success.
You know, if you can get that message across, right?
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. We're up against the
clock. Lightfoot in her place.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. We're up against the clock. Sorry to cut you off. But the other thing, too, Philip said, you know, it's a gimmick. It's a gimmick when Willie Wilson says over the course of how, you know, his adult life, he's, as he said, the last debate, he's given away something like $60 million to help people. That's a gimmick. But if the Pritzkers do it, they're wonderful philanthropists. You know? I mean, I love it.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The truth, but in for Amy this morning, I should hasten to add, is Charles Thomas, former ABC 7 political reporter. The truth may be out there, Charles, but I'm not sure we're getting it from the Pentagon, this slow-motion alien invasion we're suffering, or or spy operation of the Chi-Coms, or we don't know what.
You know, these latest ones appear to have come from the north, like over the pole. I mean, they haven't, at least when I'm watching on the news, because they have told us not much about what this stuff is. But who has a motivation to let Americans know that our airspace can be penetrated? Who would want? I think these are messages.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, we're talking, just to set the table, we're talking about this airborne object, which was described as a small metallic balloon with a tethered payload that was shot out of the sky by U.S. military over Canada on Saturday. And then Sunday, an octagonal object that looked like it had streamers attached to it. Was it a box kite? Was shot down over Lake Huron on Sunday. And that's about all we know about the... We don't know anything about who owns them or what they were doing or what exactly the nature of these aircrafts were. And there's all sorts of suggestions that... The one, according to pilots, lacked a propulsion system. And, you know, so now you're getting into X-Files stuff here. But in terms of your question, you know, who has motivation? Mike McCall, who's the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, was on with Maria Bartiromo yesterday. And he had this to say, sort of backtracking to the Chi-Com spy balloon from last week.
Why do they want to do this? Well, they're preparing, if they don't. When the election's in Taiwan next January, they are preparing for a military conflict. And they're trying to collect information about our military capabilities in the United States in preparation for that conflict. There's no question about it in my mind. And that's why that balloon was so dangerous. And it was so dangerous for the president to allow it to go forward. Once it entered U.S. airspace around Alaska, it should have been immediately shot down. It was not, and now the damage is severe in terms of compromising national security. He can't secure our borders, but now he can't secure our airspace.
So what do you make of the UFOs and extraterrestrials and Chinese spy balloons and separating them all out from one another? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Retired General Keith Kellogg was on Fox talking about both the object that was shot down on Saturday. And importantly, he thought, sort of flying in formation with Mike McCall, if you will, Chinese communist non-responsiveness on the matter.
What's amazing to me when they talk about an object and getting it shot down the first report in war is always wrong. So you know, kind of say, what's going to happen? Where's this going to? And the fact that they used the term object, they didn't use weather balloon or something similar. And when you think about, I said, okay, were they, a drone doesn't fly that high. It can't get up to that altitude, about 35,000. Mm-hmm. And that weather balloons generally travel at 60,000 feet or higher. So you got something in between. So what exactly do you have? Do you have a weather balloon that didn't get to altitude? Or do you have a drone, a new drone out there that has gone to that altitude? So they're not telling us probably what we need to know. And the phraseology of object, it should be bothersome. Yep. Mike, you know, honestly, John, my concern is the fact that we responded to this, which is important. Mm-hmm. But I think more importantly is, what are we going to respond to, and how are we going to make the point known that if you do come into our territory, our sovereign nation, national territory, what are we going to do about it? And the fact that the Chinese will not even accept a call, you know, we put that hotline in 2007 mm-hmm. with the Chinese, and Lloyd Austin can't even get a call through. Right. It's kind of, that does bother me.
I'm bothered by the fact that they can penetrate U.S. airspace, apparently at will, with these slow-moving devices, whatever they are, and what the message is that we are vulnerable. That's a bottom line, and I'm just a guy who's lives in Chicago who can see that we are vulnerable. Now, I want to speak Ukraine for a minute. I would think the Russians have a real motivation here to send us that kind of message, because as things escalate in Ukraine, the Red Army supply lines are in Russia. If you're fighting the Russians, so maybe you want to disrupt their supply lines. Are they telling us that if you do that, we're going to disrupt your supply lines? And this time around, not unlike 1917, it won't be happening over there, it's going to be here. And that's a message that I take from all this, that in this nuclearized world with ICBMs, if we can't shoot down a balloon going 50, 60 miles an hour, what are we going to do with a hypersonic missile at ICBM? And now keep in mind, I don't know this stuff. I'm just a taxpayer.
Yeah, citizen. I get it.
But That concerns me that maybe this could be the beginning of a real effort to defuse this situation in Ukraine, which I think is slowly but steadily getting out of control.
We'll get Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano's take on that at the top of the 7 o'clock hour. I don't know that this would be. I'd be a bit surprised if this was Russian in orientation, if this was a Putin initiative, but anything's possible under the sun, and the unacknowledged collaboration of Xi and Putin on certain things not because of friendship, but because of shared interest defenestrating America as the world's superpower. Everybody's got a role to play when you're talking about the axis of evil or the updated axis of evil.
Or the Chinese could be doing the same thing. Well, letting us know that, hey, look.
Well, clearly per the Luft balloon from last week, yeah, that's the case. But I also the lack of disclosure from the Pentagon, or the lack of knowledge, or the combination of the two. And I mean, you know, you can't take anything you get from the Pentagon at face value. And I know there's a recovery mission going on with respect to the object that was shot down over Canadian, veered into Canadian airspace, shot down over Alaska on Saturday. But just this briefing from National Security Council spokes being John Kirby, trying to, as reporters, including Fox's Jackie Heinrich, are trying to get just sort of the basics on this.
The Pentagon ordered this new object be taken down over Alaska.
The president ordered it. The
president ordered it. So is it a fair takeaway then that the Pentagon regrets not taking down the first balloon before it crossed the entire U.S.?
Well, I'm not going to speak for the Pentagon. I can tell you that the president doesn't regret the way that we handled the first balloon. First of all, apples and oranges here in terms of size. As I said, this was the size of a small car, and it was over very sparsely populated area, but also more critically over, it was over water, water space when we ordered this down, as we did the last one, but a completely different size, and the debris field for this we expect to be much smaller than would have been for the other one. That's difference one. Difference two, we knew for a fact that the PRC balloon that we shot down last week was in fact a surveillance asset, and capable of surveillance over sensitive military sites, and that it had self-propulsion and maneuver capabilities. There's no indication that this one did. The other one, the first one, was able to maneuver and loiter, slow down, speed up. It was very purposeful, that flight path within inside the jet stream.
So if you could distinguish the second one from the first one, then what's your overall handle on what the second one is? Right? I mean, you're describing things, but you won't tell me what you think you're describing. John Kirby, was there any communication coming from the object desirous of Reese's Pieces? Is it possible? Was he asking for Drew Barrymore? Honestly, it's just a little bit silly. Bill in LaSalle County, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. One thing I would think of a balloon or something over Lake Huron is they could be mapping out the locks at Sault Ste. Marie, because if they could disrupt the ship commerce from Lake Superior down into the other Great Lakes, you're talking you can prevent the flow of copper and especially iron ore from that region. And if you look at the way the other balloon traversed, it went over very many important sites, including the Boeing fighter jet factory in St. Louis, Missouri, as well as Oak Ridge.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Oak Ridge had been mentioned by McCall, too. Yeah, thanks for the call, Bill. Those are smart comments. Lewis on the South Side.
Good morning, Dan. They sending us a message. Not a message. You know that Valentine's Day is what, tomorrow on the 14th?
Sure is. Better remember.
Yeah. They saying, the Chinese are saying, Happy Valentine's Day. and you know what? They doing this because, who's that, the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin? He went down to the Philippines trying to reestablish some bases down there so that they could have some type of offense against the Chinese in case they try to do something against the Taiwanese. But and so that's their response right there, is happy birthday. No, happy Valentine's Day, baby.
Thanks for the call, Louis. Could have just sent flowers. John,
what time is it in the morning?
Yeah, well, you know, Lewis has he likes to use colorful metaphors, which we appreciate. Senator John Tester, he's a Democrat, Montana. He was none too happy about the Biden administration's lethargy in shooting down the spy balloon last week. He was on Face the Nation yesterday talking about the reported radar anomaly over Montana. And then he made the larger point, and again, he sits on the Defense Committee in the Senate, the larger point about the need for sort of a policy here, is this going to be sort of one-off, depending on what we believe objects are, or is it about our airspace or particular sections of our airspace? We need some more detail from Team Biden.
The truth is that there was an anomaly, and they've investigated. I think it got dark last night, so they couldn't fully check it out. And I'm sure, as we speak, it's being checked out right now.
So it hasn't been ruled out. There may still be something up there.
Absolutely. There may still be something up there. It may be a false alarm.
Okay, so there's something over the Yellowstone Ranch in Montana. Maybe there's an octagonal craft of some kind over Lake Huron. There's a small metallic balloon the size of a small car with a tethered payload over Alaska, and nobody can provide any more description or detail on it, which is what is.
I think your boy Jim Acosta at CNN suggested that it was like maybe.
They're here.
Right?
Yeah. What's gone on the last 2 weeks or so, 10 days, has been nothing short of craziness, and the military needs to have a plan to not only determine what's out there, but determine the dangers that go with it.
That seems sensible, and also provide some more disclosure, timely disclosure to the American people that's credible, as opposed to Jim Acosta playing Pictionary with us. John Kirby playing Pictionary with us. Jim Acosta, as you were mentioning, Charles, on CNN. You haven't had a discussion this intelligent since Don Lemon was positing that MH370 was swallowed in a black hole.
It's interesting. This is kind of unusual that these pilots saw different things, and that is sort of, I guess, adding to the mystery of all this.
Yeah, not even the pilots apparently were really able to identify what they saw. And just to take you back for a sec, on Thursday, the U.S. defense officials sent F-35 fighter jets up to try to figure out what this object was that was flying around near Alaska. Those pilots, we have learned, have given very conflicting accounts of what they actually experienced, with some pilots saying that the object interfered with the plane's sensors, other pilots saying that they didn't really experience that, other pilots saying that when they looked at the object, they could identify no identifiable propulsion system, and they did not know how it was actually staying in the air, cruising at that altitude of about 40,000 feet. So this has all added to the Pentagon's wariness of describing in more detail what this object actually is until they can get more information through the debris that they are recovering right now.
Mm. Sounds like my favorite episode of Battlestar Galactica. Dan and Charles Thomas in for Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is Charles Thomas, former ABC7 political reporter, also a radio talk show host. You were on WVON.
For a minute, a little bit.
Yeah. Been around this business quite a bit, quite a while.
Yeah, 50, it's 50 years this year.
I think you're going to make it. I think you're going to make it in this business.
You think so?
Yeah, after your probationary period's over. All right, let's talk about this fascinating story emanating from the Telluride Association. Vincent Lloyd is the director of Africana Studies at Villanova University. He's the author of a book called Black Dignity, which is described as, quote, a radical work by one of the leading young scholars of black thought, an effort to describe the philosophy underlying the Black Lives Movement. And he was forced into exile, as he writes in Compact, by 12 high school students that had been chosen by the Telluride Association to spend 6 weeks together taking a college-level course, all expenses paid. Now, it's not so much these 12 high school students, although it includes them, as it is his teaching assistant that's provided by the Telluride Association, a woman he just describes as Keisha. Names is Keisha. It's fascinating. This is like a new level of the story of the snake eating its tail.
Yeah. I mean, that's happening in a lot of places around the country. To be honest with you, Dan, I haven't read the complete article, but I know the general dynamic here.
Well, right. It's funny that Vincent Lloyd didn't know it, you know, and he talks about this, too. I mean, it's a very honest piece. He talks about he makes reference after this experience, which we'll get to in a moment, to John McWhorter's book calling that termed the anti-racism cult. It was an idea I quickly dismissed. He doesn't quickly dismiss it so much anymore. He writes that you had these 12 high school kids come together. And he talked about them. These are, you know, intelligent young people that are excited to be there. At least they were initially. 4 weeks later, you know, 6 week program, I sat in front of the gathered students. Now their faces were cold, their eyes down. Since the first week, I had not spotted one smile. Their number was reduced by two. the previous week they had voted two classmates out of the house. They're all living together.
Mm-hmm.
And I was next. Each student read from a prepared statement about how the seminar perpetuated anti-black violence in its content and form, how the black students had been harmed. Remember, that they're talking to the professor about this, Vincent Lloyd.
High school kids.
Right. And all sort of falling in formation with Keisha, the teaching assistant provided by the Telluride Association. Will the Telluride Association do anything about this? No, we'll get to that. How I was guilty of countless microaggressions. He's guilty of countless microaggressions. This is a guy who wrote the book Black Dignity, a radical work by one of the leading young scholars of black thought, including through my body language, among his microaggressions, and how students didn't feel safe because I didn't immediately correct views that failed to treat anti-blackness as the cause of all the world's ills. He wants to remind us that the seminar topic was race and the limits of law in America, and four of the 6 weeks were focused on anti-black racism. The other two were on anti-immigrant and anti-indigenous racism. I'm a black professor, he writes. I directed my university's Black Studies program. I led anti-racism and transformative justice workshops, and I have published books on anti-black racism and prison abolition. I live in a predominantly black neighborhood in Philly. My daughter went to an Afrocentric school, and I'm on the board of our local black cultural organization. I'm sorry, that's not good enough.
It isn't good enough in today's world. I mean, that's what you get, and you're somehow interpreted to be anti-black if you don't follow I guess this is a new train of thought that kids have in particular.
Well,
I mean,
you know, it's interesting. Get your perspective on this, because he actually harkens back to the 60s. He makes mention into the 70s. My thoughts turn to the moment in the 1970s when leftist organizations imploded, the need to match and raise the militancy of one's comrades, leading to a toxic culture filled with dogmatism and disillusion. And then he asks and he answers, how did this happen to a group of bright-eyed high school students? So what he sees is a bit of a repeat from the 60s civil rights movement moving into militancy, and then a one-upping of militancy that led to sort of the infighting and in part the collapse. Although it really, if you look at it, I guess I would argue that unfortunately the collapse was of the original vision and mission of the civil rights movement, which was legitimate, and then it moved into 50 years of race hustling, which is not legitimate.
You know, I was born in 1951, and I went to high school in the 60s, and I was a self-styled black militant in the late 60s, and I can remember elders speaking to me, hey, cool, you got to be cool. But things were a lot more defined then. I mean, there was a fight, really, a struggle in this country over statutory racism.
Right.
And which made your points of reference very clear, very defined. You knew exactly what you had to do. You had to end segregation in public accommodations, and certainly voting rights. And those things were accomplished. But then after that, I think people in my generation began to question what it was vaguely institutional racism. And we questioned, and then we got jobs in corporate America, and we stopped questioning, and we started raising our families and such. And, you know, America changed. It changed over the 50 years. Now, I've had people tell me it didn't change enough, or it hasn't changed.
Well, yeah, there are people that have, I mean, as I've long argued, flying off of the work of people like Shelby Steele and Bob Woodson and Thomas Sowell and others. I mean, there are people in this country that want it to be, you know, early 1960s Selma forever. They want you to believe it is because that's how their bread gets buttered.
Well, there's people today.
Yeah, today.
I had a person tell me last week And I was on our my own podcast, and my podcast partner told me that things for black people were worse today than they were in 1955. And this is an intelligent person. I said, really? Are you kidding? I said, what happened to you? How did you do this? How did the guy who is president in the president of Chicago Bears, that guy, I mean, where did he come from? How did that guy succeed?
Yeah, the Big Ten conference before.
Yeah.
Right.
What did he do? Right. I mean, he built a stadium in Minnesota or something. I said, what did he do? How did he make it through this web of racism? And of course, there is no real answer, but there are going to be people that are going to say that it's worse today than it was. But I can remember growing up, I grew up in a former slave state, Missouri, where there were signs. I remember them clearly, said whites only.
Right.
Restaurants you could not go into. I remember my parents holding picket signs, walking in front of these places.
Uh-huh.
To try to integrate them or whatever they called it in those days. So when I hear people today talk about this institutional racism and how it has to be fixed, number one, I ask, how do you fix it? And I believe, aren't things better today than they were back then? And they won't accept that because they didn't live back then. They didn't know. They just don't know. And when I talk about my grandfather, who I knew, who I talked to, and remember, and what he went through, and my father, who was born in 1915, what he went through, and I think about what happened to me in my life, I went through stuff, but I can honestly believe that it's better today. Also, I've been able to travel around the world, other continents. And I will honestly say to you today and to anyone who is listening that the United States of America, with black, Asian, Latino, white, all people from all over the world, is the least racist country I've ever visited. The least.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Trish Northside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, South Loop calling.
Oh,
yes,
South Loop.
Hi, Mr. Charles Thomas and Dan. Yes, I, too, am a baby boomer. I'm 70. I grew up in the era where church bells rang all over the United States, as you also will recall,
mm-hmm.
where the church preached against sin. But now we have a church that's preaching prosperity, and we're receiving the results thereof. The out-of-wedlock birth is a cycle of poverty and crime, which we, our own black people, have put upon ourselves, and we're reaping that. No Willie Wilson is going to change that. He, too, comes from the time of way back when, but he is also a prosperity preacher. And this is the problem. These children are not going to listen. There's a cultural gap. Remember, Mr. Charles Thomas, there was called a generation gap. This is a cultural gap. It's in the kindergarten, the high school, the college, the TV, from the White House to the pulpit. There is no way to return. When you have 13 and 12-year-olds carjacking, they have no conscience. They're not afraid of parents. There's no parents. This is a result of out-of-wedlock births, and we have to reap what we have sown. No one is telling these young people to close their legs like Charles Thomas. You know we heard that when we were growing up. Mm-hmm. The key is the church, and it has failed miserably, trading Christ's gospel for money and prosperity, and we are reaping the rewards. This is the consequences of no truth. These teenage kids are not going to listen to Willie Wilson. They're not going to listen to the police. They're killing the police. These things are unheard of when we were growing up. Yeah. It's the lack of morals and foundation that the church gave us, Charles Thomas. And this is the fact.
I agree with
this
you. I agree with you 100%. But I'm not willing to give up at this point. I would love to see us begin to say what you say it through the media. I mean, think about it, guys. Last night, listen, I know, but last night the halftime show was dominated by a baby mama. I mean, Rihanna is a baby mama. She doesn't.
How are you going to fight that back?
But what I'm saying is, you're right. It has become cultural, but can't we move this aircraft carrier slowly as we can? But we got to try. We just can't give up.
You keep on thinking that you can try. The only answer is for the Lord to return, because these children have run over the streets. There's a criminal mindset. They're on the train pushing people on the track. They're not listening to us. They will not listen to Willie Wilson. It is a chasm that is too deep. You have the schools teaching kids things they ought not to know, onto the TV, the commercials. It is too, you can keep believing if you want to. Maybe that makes you feel
better. Hoping. I'm not believing. I believe what I see. I'm hoping.
It's too late, my friend. It is way too late. And they not going to listen to no old Republican. That you mentioned Trump. I have a girlfriend. I don't want to hear nothing Trump got. It's hate. Hate. Even though she's a Christian, she doesn't want to hear anything about anybody that's a conservative. She goes to church. And she's against the homosexual agenda, LGBT. But if it's a Republican or conservative like you talking, she will not listen. Just like that man that called in and wanted to make himself right because there's some people that's taking care of their children, even though they're not in the house with them. No, you're not right, sir. We need a two-parent foundation. You look at any foreign national person from the Philippines to over to Africa. They believe in having marriage of a man and a woman. You have the whole society from kindergarten to college teaching perversion. What are you going to do about that? You cannot take it out of the schools. It's entrenched. They cannot have children. Therefore, they are using the schools as a missionary field to convert. What are you going to do about that? It's hopeless, sir. I'm sorry.
Trish, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. I wasn't going to interrupt Trish.
I don't know what to do, man. She brought it, man. You know,
I wish I could disagree with her, but I, you know, you do want to hold out hope. I don't know. Maybe, I mean, two things I would say. One is I've always believed, at least from my perspective, that if you're going to have a renaissance in the Republican Party, I mean, sort of a real sustained one, you're going to have black conservatives lead.
Absolutely.
That's one.
You get no pushback from me on that one.
The time for us honkies, myself included, is over. We need to step aside. Number two, and by the way, there's a good piece in the Wall Street Journal this weekend about a couple of newly minted congressmen who are persons of color and also young and representing perhaps a generational shift and improvement. The other thing is this story that we're talking about with Vincent Lloyd at Villanova. And maybe if Vincent Lloyd has the scales fall from his eyes, then you'll have the left pull itself back a little bit from the abyss such that, you know, they won't indulge things like what happened at this Telluride Association seminar. I mean, he describes, just give you an example. During our discussion of incarceration, an Asian American student cited a federal inmate demographic, about 60% of those incarcerated are white. The black student said they were harmed by the presentation of that statistic. They had learned in one of their workshops that objective facts are a tool of white supremacy. Outside of that seminar, I was told the black students had to devote a great deal of time to making right the harm that was inflicted on them by hearing prison statistics that were not about blacks. Again, this is for a radical black pro-BLM professor recounting what he witnessed, and he was surprised. I don't know why he's surprised. He hasn't been paying close enough attention, but he's surprised enough that he ended up leaving that seminar. He's like, I'm done. I can't work under these conditions. So if he can't, then maybe there will be some sort of reckoning by the center left on the radical left. Maybe that's wishful thinking.
No, I mean, I think the center right has to deal with the extreme right. I think we all need to come back to the middle, but it's going to take, for instance, on these people, on leftists who think that when I talk about nuclear family, that I'm out to lunch. No. You can't deny that.
Yeah.
You can't deny it. And you're going to have to come in this direction. And anybody who's some dyed-in-the-wool, hardcore Nazi racist is going to have to understand that what's happening there is not going, this country can't survive like that. Not in its current configuration.
Well, maybe.
Certainly. And they've got to come to the middle.
Maybe Trisha's right. Maybe it's time for rapture. And maybe we saw an indication. But did you see the Christ the Redeemer statue outside of Rio got struck by lightning?
Did you see really? And did you know that 35,000 people are dead in Turkey and Syria now?
Oh, yeah.
And the Lord said in Matthew 24, there would be birth pains before he came. Now, I read scripture, and this isn't a...
You're not predicting the apocalypse. I get it.
It's coming, man. I didn't predict it.
No, I mean, you're not predicting it, you know, tomorrow.
Well, it could happen 20 minutes from now.
Well, hopefully,
and that's
it can wait till at least 9 o'clock. Yeah. I mean, gosh.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is former ABC 7 political reporter Charles Thomas. Over the weekend, we got briefings from National Security spokesman John Kirby, if that's not an alien that's assumed John Kirby's body. We don't know. We don't know anything right now, Charles.
No, we don't, and that's amazing from what is supposed to be the most transparent administration in American history.
Of course. Well, and John Kirby could distinguish the object, small metallic ball, size of a small car, could distinguish it, that object that was shot down over Alaska over the weekend, from the Chi-Com spy balloon from the week before, but he couldn't give us any sense of the nature or purpose of it.
The Pentagon ordered this new object be taken down over Alaska.
The president ordered it. The
president ordered it. So is it a fair takeaway then that the Pentagon regrets not taking down the first balloon before it crossed the entire U.S.?
Well, I'm not going to speak for the Pentagon. I can tell you that the president doesn't regret the way that we handled the first balloon. First of all, apples and oranges here in terms of size. As I said, this was size of a small car, and it was over a very sparsely populated area, but also more critically over water space when we ordered this down, as we did the last one. But completely different size, and the debris field for this we expect to be much, much smaller than would have been for the other one. That's difference one. Difference two, we knew for a fact that the PRC balloon that we shot down last week was in fact a surveillance asset and capable of surveillance over sensitive military sites, and that it had self-propulsion and maneuver capabilities. There's no indication that this one did. The other one, the first one, was able to maneuver and loiter, slow down, speed up. It was very purposeful, that flight path inside the jet stream.
Yeah. So what is the new one? I mean, remember the spin from the Biden White House was they were spying on the spy balloon that was spying on us. They had put up shields on sensitive targets, and they were tracking. We were pulling information from the spy balloon. We did a jujitsu there. Well, why can't you do a jujitsu with that object that was floating over Alaska? It's all very bizarre, and it's trying the patience of Democrats and Republicans alike. Democrat Senator John Tester from Montana on Face the Nation.
What's gone on the last 2 weeks or so, 10 days, has been nothing short of craziness. And the military needs to have a plan to not only determine what's out there, but determine the dangers that go with it.
And House Intel Chairman Mike Turner was on with Jake Tapper, expressing frustration about not being briefed by the Biden administration, just having to be briefed by the cable news channels.
You know, this is particularly annoying about this administration. The Biden administration needs to stop briefing Congress through our television sets and actually come and sit down and brief us. What we're seeing here is a number of announcements by the administration without any real information being given to Congress. This could be because they don't have any information. From the press conference we saw, it does seem like they took this action without a real understanding for what they were going after, but having declared it a hazard. But we'll see as the information comes to Congress. But I do think that there needs to be more engagement between the administration and Congress. Probably they're a little hesitant after the Chinese balloon fiasco, where they let it go across the country to great criticism, bipartisan and bicameral criticism from Congress.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, the Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and author of the book Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, have the visitors arrived?
Yeah. Can you play the bite?
Can I play what? But which bite?
Can you?
It is balloon.
Okay.
Everybody
has their favorite bite on this. Yeah. Right.
When the first incident started, mine immediately went to that. When it proves I'm old, but it also. It just reminds me of how this administration's reaction, which does seem like something out of the Keystone Cops. I think I have an explanation for this. I will say I understand why the administration might be a bit flummoxed, because you have different objects here with different profiles, and because they were smaller, maybe they didn't pick them up sooner, and so they're reticent to kind of just declare this. But they're going to get physical evidence, so we're going to get a bit of clarity on this in a couple of days, and be able to just pow out. But I think there's an explanation that connects all these dots. That just makes sense.
What is it?
You want to know what that? So
yeah.
Look, you have to link two stories together.
Okay.
One is the announcement last week by the U.S. government acknowledging for the first time that China now actually has a bigger ICBM launcher force than we do.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have that many of ICBM launchers, they are useless unless you can target them, because you have to hold the enemy's cities. And nuclear response. You know, our ability to shoot back, whether it's bombers or land-based missiles, and command and control at risk. And for that, you need targeting data. What these balloons are perfectly designed to do is to gather signal intelligence that would help round out the targeting data. And then people, I think, they like, what's the big deal? You shoot a nuclear weapon in Montana, you're going to kill everything. Well, actually, you have to be, particularly if you're going after missile silos, you have to be pretty precise, because the missile silos are hardened. A lot of these military targets are hardened. So you actually have to get a pretty good hit to take them out. And they said, well, they have satellites. Well, the great value of satellites is you're the eye in the sky. The disadvantage of that is you know when they're going to be overhead. So therefore, there are things you can just cover up that you can't see. And from signal intelligence, you're absolutely a far better and more efficient collector as a balloon flying overhead than a satellite in space. So I think it was a deliberate campaign on the part of the Chinese to collect nuclear targeting data against the United States. Not surprising that they would send more than one asset to do this, and that the assets would have different profiles and fly at different altitudes, looking for gaps and spaces in U.S. air defenses to get through. I think it seems to be all part of a deliberate campaign. You know, now that we're into it, is it probably going to come to an end? My guess is probably yes. But I think that this lives. I think this is a Chinese effort to gain more intelligence to target their nuclear missiles, period.
Sir, this is Charles Thomas, who's subbing for Amy today. What's up with NORAD? I mean, I've been hearing about NORAD for decades. They
right.
can't pick up these devices when they fly into this hemisphere, really?
So clearly the larger one they did. And that's not surprising. You had a big, giant blip in the sky that was actually clearly emitting, sending transmissions back to China. I think all the evidence is they picked that up before it came into U.S. airspace. And they were actually just not talking about it. I mean, they were actually – had never planned, I don't think, to release this information. We can talk about why they did that. But the smaller ones, I think it's a more open question. They're smaller objects. They have different profiles. And I think maybe this is all part of an effort for the Chinese to find, you know, gaps in their ability to collect this. I will say something that people haven't really talked about, but it's really, really important. The first balloon flew at 60,000 feet. Nothing flies at 60,000 feet. The last one that they just shot down, it was at 20,000 feet. Commercial airliners fly at 30,000 feet and below. That was a menace to air navigation. People could have got killed. It could have run into something. Or with all these jets flying around and tankers flying around fueling the jets and people shooting at stuff, somebody could have got killed. So if the Chinese are behind that, and we think they do, that was I wouldn't say it was an act of war, but that was an egregious, dangerous act.
Do you think do you think that Kirby, if that is John Kirby and it's not a reptilian humanoid that's occupying John Kirby's body, do you think John Kirby knows what the two objects that were shot down over the weekend are? Do you think they have a pretty good handle on what they are, and they know the answer to the question? They could say yes or no to your supposition.
But I don't know. I will say, in fairness to the administration, and this goes to the first balloon where they said, well, you know, we were really jamming it, which, you know what? That's something you don't actually like to say in public, because if you're doing really good jamming, the other guy doesn't know you're doing that. They just think, oh, we bought, you know, crappy parts at Radio Shack or something. So to acknowledge that you detect the emissions and you're jamming it, you're telling them something. You don't like to tell the enemy about your collection capabilities. And then somebody said, well, you know what? Part of the reason why they're doing this is they're seeing how we react to it. And the answer is, well, yeah. I mean, that's true. They're going to gain some intelligence about us because they know what we can detect and our reaction times and how we react. But clearly, I do think there are constraints on what they want to say publicly. So and that probably does limit some of that. But, yeah, part of it, maybe they don't have a clue what's going on here.
You know, I feel more vulnerable today because of what's happened over the past week. I feel more vulnerable today to either nuclear or even conventional attack from a hostile nation. How about you? Do you?
Here's why you should feel a lot less secure. And I wrote an article on this on a website called 1945. The response on the balloon thing is almost exactly, in many ways, similar to the response on the border, which is they had an agenda, and even though their agenda was creating all kinds of risk for the American people, to them the agenda came first. I think it's the same thing with the balloons. If we do the timeline here, it's very clear that they knew the first balloon was coming. And that for them, it was much more important for them to engage in the Chinese and send Blinken over there than it was to take an immediate response to this. So this is an administration that the first question they want to answer is, what's good for my politics? And then if we're lucky, they're going to get around to what's good, you know, for our security. I mean, they've completely, you know, denuded the Department of Homeland Security. We're more at risk now from a terrorist attack than we were in 9/11 because of the way they've treated the Department of Homeland Security. They're playing politics with NORAD air defense rather than showing a demonstrably strong and aggressive response at the front end in a sense to scare the Chinese off. We're still doing it. We're trying to downplay this. It's a big, big mistake.
I thought NORAD was mainly for just tracking Santa Claus during the holidays anyway. So I'm glad that it has some other uses, defense uses.
So the interesting thing, and you know, we don't talk about it, of course, NORAD was started during the Cold War. It's a joint command between the United States and Canada. It's actually very actually designed to run the early warning system to track incoming missiles, because all these things, missiles, whoever shoots them at us, they're going to come over the North Pole. And also to coordinate airspace security. So before 9/11, NORAD looked outward. You know, since 9/11, NORAD's been inward and outward. Matter of fact, If this had happened on 9/11, our ability to track those balloons in our airspace would have been very minimal. But that's completely changed. NORAD also does more now on looking at maritime space and approach. So it's actually NORAD's very, very good and very, very valuable. My assessment, when all this is said and done, is the weaknesses in our response here are going to turn out to be not military capabilities, not response capabilities, but political decision makers.
And so this is potentially, one could argue, this was the CHICOMs playing a war game, trying to assess what kind of response
I think this is we have a massive missile fleet. It is no use to us unless the Americans fear that we can directly target their missiles and their cities, and we need targeting data. And this is a risk worth taking to get the targeting data we need to make all our missiles a real important thing that the Americans have to pay attention to. And so they did it, and they said, we'll live with the consequences of it.
I want to get your reaction to one other topic before we let you go. Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden, sat down for an interview with Telemundo to talk about border policy, and he was quite adamant that there are no plans to deport non-Mexican illegal immigrants to Mexico.
They say that your administration has been negotiating to deport massively non-Mexican immigrants to Mexico. Now, DHS has denied these claims, but have you been having this conversation, sir?
No.
So that reporting is completely wrong.
What you just said is completely wrong, yes.
So what's the policy that your administration is going to have in the border policy, after Title 42 is lifted?
Well, the top policy we're having is if, in fact, first of all, we engage the parole policy for those five, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Haiti, Venezuela, Cuba. And the number of people coming has declined over 90%. Because there's a regular path to do it now.
You're not considering, and you wouldn't consider, deporting massively non-Mexican immigrants to Mexico.
I'm saying we have not done that.
But would you consider it in the future, once Title 42 is lifted?
I don't think we have to do that. We have to consider that.
What do you think, Jim? There's no need for remain in Mexico because Kamala Harris solved the Northern Triangle problem.
I want to put a gun to my head. First of all, what a lie. 90% reduction in illegal crossings. This administration basically said, sign up on an app, go to a border crossing, and we'll let you walk in. So the reason why people aren't illegally crossing the border is we're just letting them walk into the United States through the port of entry. That is not a 90% reduction of anything. I mean, that is the most egregious law that's ever been said to the American people. The other thing I said, that clip that you just heard, every human trafficking cartel in the world, they are taping that, and that is an advertisement. They're going to play that for everybody. This administration will never send you back. Give me $10,000 and you can walk in the United States. This is nuts. And what's not on that tape is that if the next president of the United States doesn't have a D behind their name, they will only be elected with a mandate to secure the border and deport people in large numbers.
Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Heritage Foundation, author of Brutal War. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you, my friend.
And you joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is Charles Thomas, former ABC 7. Political reporter. Charles, I want to get your reaction to this Twitter thread I posted over the weekend. I essentially argue that, at least with respect to the campaign that he has run to this point, Paul Vallis is offering a return to Rahm. Not in those words, but effectively that's what he's offering. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I think he has launched his campaign for the runoff, and he is doing it in such a way where he's playing to the leftist sensibilities of the Chicago electorate. He's trying to, I mean, initially he was, of course, you know, he was appealing to the police union and to the more right center and conservative small number of Chicagoans. And now he's looking ahead to the runoff. And
so,
he's trying to become more centrist or left center.
Yeah, so, right, which sounds very reminiscent to Rahm.
Yeah.
And so he's trying to appeal to the non-white segment of the 70% of Chicagoans who think the city's on the wrong track.
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, I think he's going for that. That I don't think it's the non-white part of it. I think it's very white. I mean, like,
not for a runoff.
For the runoff?
For a runoff, he's got to appeal to the non-white percentage.
Well, he's got to get his share, depending on who he runs against.
Well,
in the runoff, but
well,
I think, man, you know, the people I think who are most committed to this liberal thing are the white liberals, the young white liberals, man.
Well, so this is sort of my point. So if he has to get his share of Black and Latino voters, then is this pivot to presenting himself as some sort of combo of Gloria Steinem and David Hogg with sharper pencils, does that bring in the percentage of the Black and or Latino vote that he needs in a runoff against either a Black candidate or Chewy?
Depends on who he runs against. I mean, I think, for instance, if he were to run against Brandon Johnson, he'd have a tough time getting the Black vote. I mean, he'd have a real tough time, even though Brandon Johnson would not necessarily be the best candidate for Black people. I mean,
well,
because of this whole school piece, as well as and the tax thing.
Yeah.
And what Brandon Johnson has said, and the fact that Brandon Johnson very well, at least during the first term that Brandon Johnson would be mayor, he would act at the behest of the CTU. I mean, you'd have to try to separate him from CTU, because I don't think there will be an elected school board until 27, right? So he would be vulnerable.
So do you agree with me that the only candidate Paul Vallis has a chance of defeating in a runoff is Lightfoot?
He could defeat Lightfoot for sure. Willie Wilson would be tough. Chewy would be tough, but he might be able to beat Chewy. He might be able to beat Chewy because of what he's trying now, which is moving toward the left.
But it's so ham-handed and transparent, and Chewy already occupies that spot and has for 30 years. So now I believe Paul Vallis is aligned with me, abortion on demand and banning guns and so on and so forth. So now I'm comfortable with him. I mean, how does he out left, you know, an avowed socialist like Chewy? Or did he say, well, he's now acceptable to me because I know he would be a better fiscal manager. So now I'm going to combine my comfort level with his leftism on social issues with his fiscal management chops, and I'll vote for him over Chewy. That's a calculus you think a lot of Chicagoans are going to go through? I mean, here's my thing.
Well, you've got me there, because I think he has a different set of campaign points with each candidate that with individual candidates that he might oppose in a runoff. I think he believes he's going to be in the runoff, that he's going to finish number one because of his conservative and center right base.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean anything.
Finishing first.
I mean, it means nothing.
That's why I think he's trying to slowly move out of there and position himself to be able to run against one of these far left candidates.
Why isn't he trying to help select who he'd like to run against? If you agree with me, and you seem to, that you're much more confident he has a chance to be Lightfoot than any other candidate, why is he not laying a glove on Chewy? Why is he not trying to prop up Lori?
Chewy's a paper tiger, man.
But in a runoff, he's a more formidable candidate.
Yeah, but I don't think he believes Chewy's going to make it.
Who does he believe is going to make? He thinks Lori's going to walk in?
Some of these polls are saying Lori can still pull in 15, 20%. And that's all it's going to take. It's not going to take a lot to get in the runoff.
Well, it doesn't seem to me it seems to me Chewy's floor is 20.
Chewy's floor is 20?
Yeah.
His floor?
Floor.
I don't know. He's run a very bad campaign. I mean,
I agree.
You know who Chewy is to me? Chewy is the black Bobby Rush. I mean, the Latino Bobby Rush. He's got nothing on the ground. Without CTU, there's nothing there. I mean, he's just kind of like a congressman, and that's all he is.
Yeah, I understand.
He's got nothing else.
I understand.
So I don't know that Chewy is the guy. And plus he's got a base. A lot of his base can't vote. They just cannot.
I understand.
So I just don't think it's much there now. Believe me, I'm usually wrong about Chicago politics because, man, I don't understand these people.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to crawl in the mind of a supermajority of the electorate. I understand. Something else, too, I'll take a call real quick. Jim in South Elgin, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Jen.
Morning, Jim.
I do a lot of calling in on Urban Talk Radio, and I'm supporting Willie Wilson in part because he wants to reopen a criminally destroyed MiGs airport, which will be 20 years as of next month. But also I say, you know, he's a businessman. And I think if he would have been around instead of Lori Lightfoot, Chicago would have done much better because I think he would have called in the troops to quell all the violence because Trump said, just give me permission, I'll come in. And these people say, well, we can't have Trump. Well, guess what? You don't have Trump and you had a lot of violence. You have the decline of the city of Chicago as a result.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Well, I mean, you could hardly do a worse job than Lori Lightfoot. How could you do worse? Although, I mean, the return to ROM sort of value proposition is the good old ROM days weren't all that good. I mean, he was managing the decline of the city too. It just increased in pace under Lori.
Well, I think ROM had the business,
yeah,
big guys. They were back in ROM. I mean, you hear nothing about that. Those guys being connected to Lori Lightfoot.
No.
Do you?
Except Laura
Michael
Ricketts.
Michael Sachs's of the world.
No,
No.
No. Of course not.
No.
No, of course. But again, I'm a little curious. So, for example, our friend John Garrido, recently retired Chicago police lieutenant,
he
posted about both Lightfoot and Garcia from back in the day that Jim was talking about, the Summer of Love, when the city was on fire a couple of times. And he reminds us, and there does need to be some reminding, that Lori and Chewy, along with the senior leadership of the Chicago Police Department, that are all, you know, Lori foot soldiers, mm-hmm, essentially, you know, they smeared Chicago police officers who were at Bobby Rush's office, staged there to rest after having been on shift for a minute, like they were hiding and looting his coffee and Orville Redenbacher. Yeah, right. And so on and so forth. And they continued to hold to those lies they told, the smearing of Chicago police that they did on that after that evening, even though a report found, as Garrido cited, that what they described at a press conference is not at all what happened. He writes the report. Supervisors were told to arrest officers as much as possible because they didn't know when officers would be activated back on their feet again dealing with protesters. Many were left with buses to use for resting. The officers there in the south side around Rush's office were left with nothing. It's still unclear how they gained access to the office. It was determined there was no forced entry, so it was either left unlocked or someone unlocked it for them to use. Common practice when you have a platoon of officers is you rest a portion of your team while the rest stand watch. That was the case with this team. Officers were rotated in and out while the rest of the team stood watch outside. When you're resting your officers, they're allowed to sleep, especially under circumstances that existed that weekend because they were exhausted from having been on watch or policing for like 16 hours straight and so on and so forth. So that's what actually happened as opposed to it was a shameful event and this and that. Chewy was a part of that. Part of that smearing of Chicago police officers, but he hasn't worn the jacket for any of it. Just like Brandon Johnson's trying to walk away from the fact that he was a defund the police guy.
Wasn't Chewy as well? Didn't he join in some of that rhetoric?
I'm sure. I mean, de facto, he's always sort of couching it in sort of vanilla terms because, you know, he's just sort of a vanilla guy. I mean, he's an apparatchik, right? He's not a member of the Politburo. But I just don't understand, like, Paul Vall is positioning himself in a vacuum. He's positioning himself without having to acknowledge any of the other candidates or the underlying realities. This is sort of what he does in the debates. He's just going to rise above, and by steeping his answers in data and process, he'll bore people to tears, but he'll separate himself from the ankle biters. He just rises above. He just rises
above it
all.
He can do that now. He can do that now.
Can he?
Yeah, he can do it now because I think he can depend on being the only white candidate in the race.
Mm-hmm.
He can do that now. But when it gets down to the runoff and he's dealing with a city that's two-thirds black and Latino and Asian, he's going to have to deal with it in a different way.
I know.
And I think he's thinking about that different way now.
He's got 4 weeks.
This
is a guy, he's always trying to sort of move up and down or along, I should say, right and left along the political spectrum.
And that's Rom-esque.
Yes, well, that's what I mean. Return to Rom.
Yeah, I'll buy that.
He needs is the cardigan sweater.
But Rom won a couple of times.
Yeah,
and, you know, with this kind of approach to city politics.
But he couldn't run again because he couldn't win again.
Right. Now let me ask you something. What do you think? Given our experience or the experience of November 8th, what do you think turnout is going to be for this first round in a couple of weeks from now?
20%.
20%?
25%.
Oh, my gosh.
Don't you think?
If that happens, then I think you might be looking at a Brandon Johnson versus Paul Vallis race, which will be about as black and white, no pun intended, because I'm talking issues here as opposed to race, that you will ever that you would have had in this city and
this campaign is so dismal, as I mentioned. You could, if you remove the names of the candidates from the campaign commercials, you couldn't tell the campaign commercials apart. You couldn't tell which commercial was for which candidate. The scripts are the same.
And that's why the city is in deep, deep, deep doo-doo, man, because
the who's watching those debates and who's gleaning anything from them?
Well, because there's got to be change over these next 4 years, particularly as it pertains to public safety.
I know, yeah, but I mean, 70% of the, I know, 70% say wrong track, but it's sort of like Illinois. Yeah, it's terrible, but I've given up, so I'm not participating.
I can see that. I sense it around my building when I talk to people that they aren't really engaged.
Maybe I'm being a little cynical. Maybe people will pick up attention as there's a push here in the last couple of weeks. Maybe it'll be in the 30s or low 40s. I think the performance of the city and the performance of the candidates that offer a different path for the city has been so lackluster. I see an enthusiasm deficit, and that usually means low turnout, like perhaps even historically low turnout. You know, I mean, what's the impetus? I'm gonna go run and die in a hill for Paul Vallis. I mean, I tweeted this too. It's just like, so, I mean, in this, let's say, you know, Vallis somehow runs the gauntlet. Like he gets Lightfoot in a runoff and he wins. So why? I know he's supposed to be an agent for change, institutional change, but what institution has he challenged in this campaign? The press corps, the identitarian hustlers, the C-suite cowards, the aging machine hacks, you know, the groups of people responsible for the city's demise. Where has he, like, drawn lines and said, thou shalt not cross again? I haven't seen it.
You mean rhetorically in the campaign?
Yeah. I haven't seen it.
Well, I go back to what I said a few seconds ago, that whoever is elected mayor is going to have to restore, public safety. He's going to have to do something about CTA. He's going to have to do something about the Mag Mile, whatever, and State Street going down the tubes, and what's happening in the neighborhoods, these criminals running amok.
Yeah.
They're going to whoever is elected. I don't care if it's Willie Wilson, Paul Vallis, Lori Lightfoot. I just don't think she's had her shot. Brandon Johnson, whomever, they're going to have to do that.
I mean, you know, oh, by the way, there were 700 murders a year under Rahm, too. The difference here is the last 4 years is it's moved to areas of the city that people actually care about.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to show, we're going to see that. That's what we're seeing with Paul
Vallis.
Well,
Ballas I know, but right so what? We're going to have a return to, you know, enough policing and political backing of policing that the Mag Mile and Lincoln Park and Lakeview and Streeterville and River North are safe again, and that's going to mean a renaissance for Chicago. It's not.
Hey, man,
look, it's not.
Let me whisper. Let me do it, Joe Biden. You're going to have police being proactive, stop and frisk.
Huh?
That's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to happen.
I only believe you because you use sotto voce. That's the only reason I believe that could happen.
Did a Joe Biden did a sleepy on you, but. You know, that's what's going to happen. They're going to have to make it inhospitable for the bad guys to venture into the neighborhoods, stealing the cars, the carjacking, the robberies. They're going to make it inhospitable. And the only way they're going to do that is by some seriously, you know, iron-fisted kind of policing. They have to be sure that when they do that, that they do it constitutionally. And that's why I think Willie would actually be the best candidate,
well,
because he'd be very sensitive to that.
Whoever that person is, they better be hoping the Supreme Court holds the Safety Act unconstitutional. Mark on the South Side.
Hey, how you doing, guys? I just wanted to go ahead and say I agree with Charles. I've had these conversations a couple of months ago, and I personally believe that the runoff is going to be between two or three people, between Paul, Lori, or Brandon. I think Chewy comes in a strong fourth, but I think Paul is, I think just going off of what Charles said, Paul is your strongest candidate right now. He's the only white male, only white man that's running right now at the moment. So he's going to collect a huge number of votes on that regard and going to get a huge amount of support. I've been up north, whether it's Wicker Park, West Town, I've been all the way out south, whether it's, in certain areas such as Beverly and close to that Mount Greenwood area. And I can tell you right now, he's getting a huge amount of support. And he's getting a huge amount of black support as well, believe it or not. I was at a dinner not too long ago, and he had a huge amount of black support. I think Paul is the top runner right now. The question is, who's he going to be going against? And
yeah, Mark,
if Paul pulls it out altogether.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Appreciate it. Well, the only way he pulls it out has a potential to, I would say again, is if Lori Lightfoot is the nominee and he should be, or is his opponent in the runoff, and he should be working to help make that happen.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning, former ABC7 political reporter Charles Thomas. Jason Furman of Harvard, former Obama economic guru, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under one President Obama, tweeting, some of that inflation slowdown that people, including me, were excited about might have just been a seasonal adjustment quirk. Core CPI, Consumer Price Index, for the last 3 months of the year goes from 3.1% to 4.3% with the new seasonal factors that the Bureau of Labor Statistics just released. So maybe we're not out of the woods yet when it comes to prices declining to pre-pandemic levels and what that will mean for the availability of credit and economic growth and employment and all of the other factors in our economy. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by John Tammany, editor at realclearmarkets.com, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, author of The Money Confusion, How Illiteracy About Currencies and Inflation Sets the Stage for the Crypto Revolution. John, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Uh-oh, Jason Furman says he went to, he's a professor at Harvard.
Uh-oh.
You better not cross him, John. So what do you have to say to Jason Furman?
Oh, I feel if you looked it up, you'd find that no one alive has rebutted Jason Furman more than I. So,
wow.
So if I cross him, it won't be problematic. I've done it numerous times. To blame, say that rising prices cause inflation is like saying that suntans cause the sun to shine. At best, it reverses causation.
Post hoc ergo prompter hoc fallacy is what you're saying. Yes. Okay.
Prices go up and down for all sorts of reasons. That is a market economy. If a price is going up, Super Bowl tickets last night cost between $10,000 and $40,000. When I first went to a game in 1987 for the Super Bowl, they cost a little over $100. Is that inflation? No, that's just a lot more demand for something that is limited in supply. That's not inflation. If you had a cell phone back in 87, you were most likely someone who was extraordinarily rich. Now they're commonplace. Is that deflation? No, that's just productivity. Prices go up and down, and so that the CPI is moving around, I don't think means very much. To me, inflation remains a devaluation of the unit, as in our dollar. And we haven't seen that in recent years. And so I go back again to what I've said on your show before. To me, the higher prices are a statement of the obvious. You can't shut down the global economy and eviscerate remarkably sophisticated global cooperation and expect prices to remain the same. They were going to be higher by nature.
Right. But then the question is, when can we expect supply to come closer to meeting demand and see prices reduced? Because it's not in controversy that people, middle-income people, for example, are paying more from their take-home pay to the essentials of life, like groceries.
Well, the first thing I'd say is this is not a supply problem. Supply and demand, by definition, match each other. We know that. That's just basic.
Well,
you're a Bastiat fan, so am I. By definition, and if there's a limited supply.
Yeah.
Well, no, but okay, but if there's a limited supply of I don't know, chicken breasts such that they're higher, as a rule, there's less demand for other things. And so it's important to point out that right now, inventory within businesses has never been higher. If you're Dell Computer, if you're Nike, if your business is like that, you have lots of excess. And so prices must fall if prices are going up. What I keep arguing is that how we got to such low prices in February of 2020 was a consequence of immense and wildly sophisticated global cooperation. Why did Henry Ford successfully make the car accessible to most anyone? He did by dividing up labor in specialized fashion. Well, suddenly that specialized division of labor was eviscerated. You can't rebuild that overnight. And so for when politicians say, well, hey, it's inflation, to me, that's more offensive than Obama saying you didn't build that. You expect them to build the amazing thing that they built, rebuild it overnight? I mean, please. Of course prices are higher. It's not demand and supply. It's that we have to get back to where we were, which was a miracle.
Now, you suggest routinely that the Fed's control over the economy is vastly overstated. But the problem I see is that the trading markets disagree with you, and the performance of the trading markets is impactful in terms of the sort of liquidity in the economy and people's willingness to invest, willingness to
spend. How do the trading markets disagree with me? How do they disagree with me?
Well, because they place a lot of importance on Jay Powell's pronouncements, don't they?
Well, you say that, but back in the 2000s, the Fed was aggressively cutting rates and stocks were plummeting. Back in 2007, 2008, the Fed was aggressively cutting rates and stocks plummeted. So I don't see what you're saying. If central banks could do as it's assumed they can do, just stimulate markets, why is the Japan's stock market exponentially higher than ours because they've been at zero for decades. Yet, in fact, their stock market is still roughly half of where it was in 1989. If the Fed could shrink, if the Fed could cut rates and just cause the stock market to rally, well, by that measure, GM, or actually GE and AOL and Yahoo and Enron and Tyco would still be some of the most valuable companies. Because the Fed was aggressively cutting rates back then. Where are they today?
But I mean, those are, I understand, one-off companies. But I mean, I guess my large point, you don't think that all the attention paid to those Fed board meetings and what the rate hike is going to be in February, and now what's going to be in March, and is that going to be the last hike, and so on and so forth, all the stuff that dominates the those investotainment shows on CNBC and so forth, that doesn't impact the decisions that corporations make, the decisions that individual investors make, and those decisions don't have ripple effects in terms of our growth.
The assumption is, oh, we'll see if the Fed cuts rates. Oh, yeah, stocks just go up.
Not exactly, but that's not exactly what I'm saying.
That's kind of what you're implying. So what you're saying is that half of the market knows what you know, but the other half is just blithely selling shares as though they don't know what you know. For every market, there's a seller and a buyer. And so this notion that the Fed can just stimulate stock market rallies by fiddling with rates presumes a level of information asymmetry that staggers the mind.
All of the Fed asset purchases over the last decade, you know, the quote unquote quantitative easing, that doesn't create market distortions.
I'm sure it does in treasuries and everything, but why would that? What would that have to do with economic growth? Japan's had exponentially more quantitative easings over the years. Where's the stock market rally been? Where's the distortion been there?
It can be a distortion that goes either way. I'm just saying it's a distortion. I'm not saying that cut rates, market goes up. I'm saying that the Fed paternalism when it comes to markets matters based on what you see in terms of reaction to Fed policy from the markets. I mean, you were a wealth manager at Goldman, right? And Credit Suisse, you've been in the industry. So what the Fed did or didn't do, these market interventions by central bankers, you didn't pay any attention to those things?
No, I thought it was a waste of time. But you see, when I was at Goldman, the Fed was aggressively cutting rates and stocks were falling just in a sickening way, such that most of the people there were laid off. And so this notion that the Fed can bail out markets and bail out Goldman Sachs, well, boy, I sure didn't witness it. The NASDAQ was in free fall, and so was the Dow. And I'm just saying, if the Fed could prop up markets, as is broadly assumed, we would be too poor to be having this conversation right now. Because think about what that would imply. It would imply that they could keep the present in place. Well, see, in the year 2000, the most valuable company in the world was GE. The two most dominant internet companies were Yahoo and AOL. The best managed company in the world was Tyco. The smartest company in the world was Enron. How are those doing today? And so
but nobody's arguing it's the only variable. I'm arguing it's a variable.
But they are. But I'm not. And I've been fighting, and the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, the Fed's easy money policies, that causes stocks to rise. No acknowledgement that central banks around the world have been doing the same thing with no similar rally. And no acknowledgement of a simple truth because you said, you can't just use one-offs. But see, one-offs are what drive the market. What drove this market until recently? Five companies.
Right.
Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, you can name the Apple. Are you going to tell me those companies were actually were kind of humdrum, but they had the Fed behind them? But see, those companies back in 2000, Apple was near bankruptcy. Google wasn't even public. Amazon was Amazon.org. So we have to either acknowledge that the U.S. is full of great companies, which is what I say, or we have to go the Obama route. That, no, actually, the companies kind of suck, but the Fed props them up.
You didn't build that.
I reject that notion outright.
Yeah. I mean, so then when you look at the market today, not that you're providing advice and counsel for investment purposes, but, I mean, what's your handle on the vitality of Fortune 1000, and what's your optimism or lack thereof in terms of where the American economy goes this year?
I'm always optimistic because the U.S. is full of the most enterprising people on earth. It's always going to go up. My strong sense is that that this next rally, whenever that happens, is going to be companies that we've never heard of. Remember, not too long ago, the view was that Google had an impregnable monopoly. ChatGPT kind of blew that one out of the water.
Right.
And this is the source of the U.S. stock market's vitality. It's not the Fed. Oh my God, the notion that Jerome Powell and Ben Bernanke and those clowns could actually cause the smartest, deepest markets in the world to go up, to cause basically some investors to be stupid and sell while others buy, is just laughable. But what we do consistently see, and this is the source of stock market vitality, is that the greats are constantly being replaced by even better. And amazing to think that Facebook, which seemed impossible to beat, doesn't seem to be doing as well right now. Again, Google was caught flat-footed in the way that Microsoft, which was once thought to be a monopoly that couldn't be beat, was caught flat-footed by the smartphone, by the internet itself. And so we're going to see it over and over again. And there's your rally. Not the Fed. Oh my gosh. Why do conservatives keep insulting the United States, these entrepreneurs, by saying the Fed makes all this happen, or even some of it?
John Tamney, editor of RealClearMarkets.com, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, author of The Money Confusion, How Illiteracy About Currencies and Inflation Sets the Stage for the Crypto Revolution. John, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning is Charles Thomas, former ABC 7 political reporter, you'll recall.
And having a great time.
Great to have you. And you're going to be back tomorrow?
Absolutely.
Too. All right.
Can't wait.
Well, the inhumanity at the hands of COVIDians has not dissipated much, at least where they can ply it. This story comes to us from our friend Emma Woodhouse at her Substack, Wood Space House. A friend of hers contacted her about her mom, who's 73 years old. She tripped at her home, fell, dislocated her shoulder. She called 911. Ambulance took her to Good Shepherd Hospital in Barrington, where she spent 3 days before being transferred to a Lutheran rehab facility in Arlington Heights. Over the weekend, she developed a fever, cough, fatigue, so they tested her for flu, RSV, and COVID. Flu and RSV negative, positive for COVID. And you know what that means, to the isolation chamber for you. Isolated in the COVID unit where she has to stay for 10 days, no visitors, no opportunity to retest and be transferred back to a regular floor. Would that have been the same if she tested positive for flu and RSV or RSV, I wonder? I don't really wonder. The administrative office has been calling this woman's daughter, Emma Woodhouse's friend, as her medical power of attorney to come in to sign paperwork for Medicare. But the daughter saying, no, my mom is of sound mind. I'm not coming in as an exercise power of attorney because there's no reason for me to do that. She can sign it herself. Well, she can't sign it herself because administration isn't allowed on the COVID floor. Very strict numbers as far as how many employees can be in the COVID unit at one time, this woman was told. She said to the administrative person, then I guess you're going to have to wait until she gets out. She also recounted, the woman whose mom is in the COVID isolation chamber at this rehab facility in Arlington Heights, that her mom is not getting the same level of care in the COVID unit. It's not as well staffed, so they can't be responsive to her need to go to the bathroom, for example. So they put a diaper on her, which is humiliating for her in her state. The call buttons in the unit don't even make noise. They turn a light on over the door. When a nurse or aide happens to be walking by and sees your light, they come in. My mom was a nurse for her whole professional career. She's not stupid. She knows how this works. The facility also said on Friday they can't get her more pain medication. Remember, she dislocated her shoulder until Monday. For the COVID, they're giving her Tylenol. How can they do this to someone within the past calendar week was able-bodied and active enough to live independently? Why are they still doing this to anyone? It's demoralizing, it's dehumanizing, and a complete fiasco. Yeah, and it persists. It persists, the COVID orthodoxy, covering our bases to all that we did over the last 3 years. We better keep doing it in small amounts to say, hey, we're still doing this. We think it works.
They can kick it in again if they have to.
Pay no attention to all these meta-analyses that are coming out that we've talked about on the ineffectiveness of masks, on the destruction of the lockdowns, particularly on kids, particularly as it relates to their social, emotional, intellectual development. Keep up appearances, even if you have to demoralize and dehumanize a senior citizen. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Jeffrey Tucker, founder and president of the Brownstone Institute and the author of Liberty or Lockdown. Jeff Tucker, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
That's a pleasure to be here. It's a tragic story. But it all is kind of baked into the entire flattened curve kind of ethos that began on March 20th. We're now 3 years to flatten the curve.
Yeah.
That's just 2 weeks. You know, it was all rooted in a fundamental mistake that we could treat COVID like AIDS or like cooties. You know, the playground game you play as a kid. You try to stay away from the germ. And that was the goal from the very beginning. That was the basis of track and trace, is the basis of lockdowns and travel restrictions and why you couldn't sing in church and you couldn't go to the gym and everything. Everything was designed to stay away from the germ so that we could control it and minimize it. Now that, you know, was always an error. For generations, we've known that this type of bug is the sort of thing you would necessarily get exposed to, and your immune system would take care of the rest. And we were, generations were taught that in ninth grade biology. It's a little bit counterintuitive, but it's a mark of a high civilization that you understand that not, you know, that the key to life is not just entirely avoiding the microbial kingdom, you know?
Right.
And so we knew this and understood this, and it was a burden of public health for the better part of a century to teach this to every generation. And then one day they just shut that knowledge off and said, everybody run to the bug, it's coming to get you, just stay away. Now, and you recall this. I mean, you're in public life. You're calming down the stuff every day. I mean, how often during the spring and summer and the winter and the spring and summer and fall and winter, for the last 3 years, have you actually said to out loud that the main purpose, your best strategy is to get healthy, get exposed, get upgraded, you know, get your immune system making this particular pathogen endemic in your body like we do with all colds and flus and everything else. And that is the path to working through this pandemic. I mean, you didn't say that very often. I didn't say that very often. And the reason was that it was basically sort of a taboo. They successfully tabooized, I guess I don't know what the right word is, good public health measures. I mean, so that we couldn't even talk about it or say it very plainly, because otherwise, you know, there would have been the New York Times saying, Chicago, the Morning Answer says everybody should get infected.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah.
So we couldn't say basic truths, and it got so bad. I was trying to remember this morning exactly when it was that the World Health Organization actually changed its definition of herd immunity. Well, it turns out that happened in the second week of November 2020, where the World Health Organization said herd immunity comes about by getting injected with a vaccine, not by being exposed to the live pathogen. Okay, they actually said this. Now, two or three months later, they changed it back again. But so here you have the World Health Organization itself wiping out the knowledge of 2,500 years just, you know, by some intern, you know, with a few keystrokes. And,
you know, it's a very interesting issue as to why this happened. And I've been thinking about that a lot in the last couple of days.
Well, I mean, just as we continue, as I mentioned at the outset, to have more meta-analyses done, more studies done, trying to assess the impact of these COVID responses. Also, we're getting more information about what these public institutions, governments, did during COVID. For example, according to one New York City organization, a legal group there, New York City teachers who declined to get the COVID vaccine had their personnel files flagged and their fingerprints sent to the FBI and the New York Criminal Justice Services. Yeah.
So, the whole system is organized around the marketing and testing of a new technology. I mean, that's my bottom line. I think that that was the goal from February of 2020 and remains the goal today. And you cannot market and test a new technology on a population that's already acquired natural immunity. Why? Because they don't need it. And from the pandemic planning point of view, what they needed was a customer base. Therefore, the goal became to keep as many people away from the pathogen as possible to keep them from upgrading their immune system and therefore their health, so that we would become dependent on shots for our existence. Now, the plan was pretty darn insidious, if you ask me, but here's where it went wrong, and you know the end of the story, right? I mean, what went wrong was the vaccine did not work.
Well,
that was not something they had anticipated, I don't think.
That it didn't work to stop the spread, which is what that was advertised to do. And now we find out, by the way, I mean, so it didn't work to stop the spread, and we find out from Tony Fauci in this paper that was released the other week that, he had good reason to believe that a non-mucosal vaccine would not stop the spread. So he was knowingly perpetrating a fraud on the entire world for that period of time, where he was getting people to repeat after me, get a vax and you can't get infected and you can't infect others.
It's a little weird. The thing is that you probably knew this at the outset. I certainly did from the very earliest age when people are, you know, I don't know when they started talking about vaccine publicly. I mean, we know they were planning this for a long time before, but when they started talking about a vaccine, I think it might have been, I don't know, let's just say it was April 2020 when I first heard word of this. And I just laughed. Ha, 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 ha. Oh, sure. You can't vaccinate against coronavirus. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows that. It's going to mutate too much. By the time you get a vaccine, the variant will change. Then it will be ethical. You have to change the vaccine. And then you risk hardwiring the immune system to one particular variant and making it vulnerable to not only new variants of the same pathogen, but other forms of pathogens that otherwise would infect you. And so I knew this. I knew every bit of this going on. I wrote this. I said, I can end this pandemic with a potion. So there's nothing in Fauci's article that is news. But what's strange is that we had to pretend like none of this was true for the better part of 2 years.
But the news is that Fauci was saying, I mean, the news is his name on an article that confirms that he knew what he was saying was untrue. I mean, it's nice to have the evidence.
Right. So why would you say untrue things for the better part of 2 years? Like, why would you do that?
Right.
And look, the answer is pretty obvious. It became an industrial machine with a product that they wanted to sell. And when people didn't want to buy it, they made you get it. And when they didn't, made you get it, and you still refused, and they put you on a wanted list.
Yeah.
Like, this actually happened in the United States of America. I mean, there's no minute of the day that I'm not just constantly outraged by this.
And it requires groups like this Teachers for Choice organization. It's being represented by Alliance for Defending Freedom at New York City to bring this to light. I mean, I you know, it's funny because you simultaneously see two things, like a lack of really an impetus to hold people accountable for the decisions they made and for the lies they told, purposely so. And on the same time, you see quietly people just walking away, right? The lack of adoption of your second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth booster. They're done with it, but they want to be done with it. And I guess that's just the nature of the human condition. We just it was an ugly period. We just want to move on. We don't want to have to deal with it anymore. And unless, you know, our mom is being quarantined at a Northwest suburban hospital, then we're just going to move on to our lives.
That's the idea, I think, and that's what they, you know, I mean, the statue's amnesia, you know, he went in before sworn testimony for this trial brought on big tech censorship. And over 7 hours, he said, I can't recall, you know, somebody like 9 times, okay? No, more than 200 times. So, you know, amnesia is the new pandemic. And it's very bad because we really, like, if we don't want this to happen to us again, we really need to learn and remember and deal with the reality. It's uncomfortable. This is a terrible period in our lives. We're all damaged from it. But the people who do remember and learn the lesson are the heroes of the day, as far as I'm concerned, because they're studying new organizations, new technologies, new ways of schooling, even new churches, new professional societies, new think tanks, everything to deal with the terrible reality that we confronted and not pretend like it didn't happen to us. We have to come to terms with this. I mean, this is what, you know, obviously I do this every single day, and so do you. It's extremely important we understand something went very wrong in this great, great, great country that was founded to defend human rights and freedoms, where one day we woke up and they were all gone, you know? So, and it could happen again unless we get some openness and admissions and some accountability. Speaking of accountability, last week, I don't know if you caught the news of this, but Brownstone Institute sponsored a group called the Norfolk Group that put together a kind of a blueprint, a template for accountability for investigations and all this kind of stuff, and went through 10 areas of failures and cited all the science at every step where, you know, it's designed to, these are the questions we need to ask people at all levels of society, from big tech to big media to public health to government officials, everybody involved in decision-making to find out exactly what they were thinking on all these subjects. And it's not just for the federal level. This blueprint is designed for all the states and the cities and the counties and really, you know, every country in the world where these same plans were enacted. And so that we can, you know, have a coming to terms with what happened.
Well, look for that. Look for, yeah, that Norfolk Group blueprint. Very good.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Tucker.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeffrey Tucker, founder and president of the Brownstone Institute, author of the book Liberty or Lockdown. Jeffrey Tucker, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
And you join us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.